This is Don Shy, the parapublicist, and you're listening to Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred.
Views and opinions expressed by Paratrinity Radio and their guests are solely theirs and do not represent the views and opinions of ASPRN or its affiliates. Welcome to Paratrinity Radio. Your hosts, Mike and Ellie, plan to delve into the controversial subject of religion and the paranormal.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord give my soul to be.
Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred. Powered by the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network. Hey, everybody. We are back with another episode of Paratrinity Radio. I'm your host, Mike.
And I am Ellie.
And I wanted to start just a couple minutes early tonight to make a few little ASPRN announcements. There have been a lot of changes going on here, and they're all for the best, and I hope to see everyone coming back more often, because this is very exciting for all of us. As you can see, we have a brand new website up, just launched about 2 hours ago. Yes, I had to count that on my fingers.
Yeah, that was great education that you got. You know how to count on your fingers now.
But I got this new website. We're very excited about that. We've got some new shows coming up. Jody Cook, Jody Cook is going to be hosting a new show called Ohio Crypto Radio. For those of you who are not familiar with Jody Cook, he is from the History Channel's Monster Quest, the Ohio Grassman episode, and he has done shows or appearances on shows on the Sci-Fi Channel and the Learning Channel in the past as well. And he has also written 2 books. And I would have to go digging to find the exact titles. They're kind of long, so I don't know those offhand. But his website's at OC4, like the number 4, BFS.com, and that talks all about him. And he will be starting on Thursday, April 8th. I believe that's this upcoming Thursday, correct?
Yes, it is. Hooray!
Stay tuned for him, and there are other shows coming in the future, so keep checking back. We'll have breaking news updates on the homepage whenever we get new information on new shows, new events, anything like that. And the ASPRN network is kind of under new management. Mike Baker is still the owner. He still runs it all, but he has kind of taken a step back and put Crystal Brooks, the host of Paranormal Outreach Radio, which airs every Wednesday night at 10 o'clock now. She is now the station manager, and I, Mike, am her little assistant. So I get to do whatever she tells me to do. Yay.
Yes. So. And she has employed a certain person to fire you if you mess up.
Yes. Okay. 7-year-old daughter. So we expect big things, new things, exciting things to come, and I just wanted to throw that out there for everyone. And so enjoy the new and exciting ASPRN. There are lots of great shows all week long. We've got the schedule up. We've got schedule on the homepage, blah, blah, blah. So now, welcome to Paratrinity Radio.
Woohoo.
How are you doing?
Who? You. Me? I'm good.
I'm staring at you.
Sometimes you look at me and you're talking to somebody else. But anyway, everything is great. I am good. It's been pretty good.
I wasn't prepared for pre-show talk, so as far as I'm concerned, we can go ahead and get the guests, introduce the guests. Do you have any pre-show talk?
No.
But I just, my pre-show talk.
No, that was pretty awesome. I think we can get... What?
I've been kind of busy with all the updates.
Yes, you were. You went into la-la land of updates. But yes, we can start.
Okay. All right, so our guest tonight is Diona Kelly Said. She is a Muslim paranormal investigator. She is a part of a group out of North Carolina, and I am so sorry, but I don't remember the name of the group. She'll tell us in just a moment. And she...
There it is, Haunted North Carolina.
I saw that. That's why I went silent. Where? Oh, there it is. All right.
She's right in front of you.
And she's currently working on a book. And that book is titled I had you at. Sounds so stupid now. I'm sorry. You had me at. That's you. That's the word I was confused on. I wanted to say I or whatever. It's you had me. So I knew that. I really did. I've done my research. But
I'm sorry.
So since I've butchered it completely, Diona, why don't you give yourself a better introduction, please?
You have to let me stop laughing before I can do that. So much for that pre-show call that you made a couple of days ago.
I get on air and my mind just...
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. My name is Diona Kelly Said, and as you mentioned, I am an investigator with this little group in North Carolina called Haunted North Carolina. The group has been around since 1992. It's a Taps family member, and we were actually featured on season 2 of Ghost Hunters during the USS Battleship North Carolina episode. Not myself, but our two founders. So we're actually a pretty well-known group here in the Southeast, and the group has also been featured on Discovery Channel and Travel Channel as well. And I want to give a shout-out to a fellow investigator in the chat room, Iris. We have another HNC-er in the house.
Welcome, Iris. Good to see you here.
Thanks for listening.
And as you mentioned, I do have a book slated for 2011 release, called You Had Me at Boo, America's Fascination with the Paranormal, from Llewellyn Press. And the book looks at... I'm sorry?
I love that title, You Had Me at Boo. That's just awesome.
Thank you.
It is awesome.
Thank you. The book looks at reality television's influence on the field, as well as the way people are now discussing religion and, to some degree, science, and other issues in popular culture. So it's a really thorough investigation of this whole reality TV genre, looking at Taps as the case study and Taps families, looking at how Taps families are actually taking media interest and utilizing that in their own neighborhoods by investigating at historic properties and using the media to promote interest in local properties. And I also talked to clergymen and quantum physicists and people in the field, just to get a sense of really how the field has transformed in the past 7-8 years.
So what made you decide to embark on writing this book? And like, what really just clicked in your head that made you say, I have to write this?
Well, I am a writer, and I have written on everything from foreign policy to Islam to creative art. I actually had a weight loss column when I was living abroad in the Kingdom of Bahrain. So I was already a writer when I got in the field. But I actually got the idea when I was listening to Beyond Reality Radio back when they actually did the radio program, and Troy Taylor was on. Now, those of you who do not know, Troy Taylor is a very prolific author on paranormal issues. I think he has Whitechapel Press Publishers. Great guy, and he did an episode on spiritualism, and he talked about how spiritualism really opened the door for what we call today paranormal research. And interestingly, spiritualism was a very American philosophical movement, and what we do as paranormal investigators in many ways is a very American thing. It certainly is a very much a Western cultural thing, because you don't see this going on in non-Western societies very much. It may change now that you have the global broadcast of Ghost Hunters and Ghost Hunters International, but the way we approach paranormal events is very unique. And I was like, wow, that's so cool that there's something unique about the way we express our American identity in this thing called ghost hunting.
So how do they, like, I know that they do, I guess you could say, research in the paranormal and spirits and all that. What do they do as opposed to investigating? Just strictly stick with the research, or do they have some sort of spirit communication of some sort of ritual or anything like that?
Well, you have to define they, because once you leave the West, you're looking at a multitude of different cultures and different religions, and everyone has their own approach. And in Japan, you have a certain idea, and in Africa, you still have a strong animist shaman perspective. People don't really research the paranormal outside of Western societies, but in some areas of the world, you still have the tradition of spirit communication through a shaman, a medicine man, or a spiritual person. So, you know, quantifying it as we do in the West, trying to actually collect evidence and looking at it as a separate phenomena is very unique, and it's quite fascinating to me that we do that.
So in the Islamic culture, is it accepted that of what you're doing here with the way we investigate and you being a part of it, is that accepted by the culture, or?
Well, we're going to find out, I guess, within the next year or two as I go more public. I'll probably have a fatwa issued against me at some point. The short answer is probably not, because I'll get into this a little bit later in the broadcast, but Muslims in general do believe in inhuman entities, not necessarily evil, but inhumans called jinn. And jinn are thought to have free will, so they can be Christian or Muslim or Jewish or whatever, and some are thought to be downright evil. And it's general consensus that only the evil ones will sort of interfere in our realm, and you're not to try to communicate with them in any way. So they might see what I'm doing as an attempt to communicate with jinn. The concept of ghosts or spirits or souls of the departed isn't very popular in Islamic theology, so some people may take offense to what I'm doing. I try to, you know, steer it more towards a quantum physics kind of discussion, and we can get into that a little bit later in the broadcast, but I don't know. I have no idea what's going to happen once I publish my book. No, Osama bin Laden might be after me. I don't know.
Well, let's hope not.
So, your book... television, the media coverage, or the media influence on the paranormal field. This is something that we talked about for almost 2 hours on the last edition of Paraternity Radio, last episode. And I always kind of felt that it really hurt the field. Yeah, it got me into the field, so I can't be too mad at them. They're the reason I started. But at the same time, it seems like it's brought in a lot of, I want to say, bad investigators, bad names.
You mean weird people, weirdos.
Yes. Yes, I mean the ones that just seem to, they think it's a game. They don't understand that, you know, this does have a seriousness to it, that, you know, you have to be careful, and that you can't just go out there willy-nilly and do whatever you want and not suffer any kind of consequences.
So have you found that media has helped or hurt the field?
You know, that's a very loaded question. I think it's done both. And obviously, I'm in this field, too, because of Ghost Hunters. There's no shame in saying that. I certainly had experiences all my life, and I was deeply frightened by these experiences. But when I saw Ghost Hunters, I'm like, wow, you can actually approach it from a very deductive, intellectual way. And I thought that was awesome. But getting back to your question, I think what happened, I actually talked to John Zappas about this. He said prior to Ghost Hunters, it was really difficult to come out as someone who was involved in the field. There was still a stigma to it. You certainly couldn't be in corporate America and say you were doing this. Patrick Burns was one of them. He had to be very quiet about it. And then when Ghost Hunters came out, it suddenly became really cool to do paranormal investigation. So what the shows have done, one very positive thing, is it's opened a cultural space for us to address these issues, an unprecedented cultural space. What we do with that space depends on those who are involved in investigation at the grassroots level. And this is both positive but also problematic. Because of this almost celebrity element of ghost hunting, it's brought out some very, very strange people in a field that did attract marginalized people in the first place.
Yes. Go ahead.
I think a lot of people watch the shows and then say, ooh, that looks like fun. So they go out and try to do exactly what they saw on TV, not realizing what they see on TV is strictly for entertainment. It's not necessarily the how-to ghost hunt show. So they go out there trying to do what they see on TV, and it's not what they expect. So then they just bumble around, look kind of stupid, and look bad.
Well, some of them don't understand that, you know, Ghost Hunters and Ghost Hunters International actually has permission to go into these places. Some people just, you know, tune in not paying attention to that part and just start trespassing and, you know, stuff goes down, to say it nicely.
You know, you bring up a very interesting point. Trespassing has been a problem in the field, but now more complicated legal issues are emerging because there's so many investigators, and it's not just going into property that without permission. I believe that's actually happening less and less in a sense because people are more enlightened. But you're now seeing theft within paranormal groups, or theft between paranormal groups, not only of equipment but of evidence. You're seeing more and more people go into client homes and make outrageous claims, which are quite distressing to the client. On the other end, you have clients now who watch the shows, and they have a preconceived notion not only what type of evidence they want to expect, but also what they want to see during an investigation. So if you come into a home and you're not doing it exactly like they see it on TV, they think you're full of crap.
Right. They assume that you don't know what you're doing, or that you can't, you're second rate because you don't have a telescope the size of Hubble to view things, and, you know, coming in with at least 20 different things of luggage like a normal woman does when she's going to a weekend trip.
Yeah, exactly. And if you don't get anything, and we know that many, many times, in fact, most of the time we really don't recover any evidence from an investigation, they get quite angry, then they will bring in every team until they hear what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And Iris in the chat room makes a good point, is that people think this is something new. This has been going on for a long time. I mean, from the mid-1800s, psychical researchers have been studying anomalous events in one form or another. This isn't new. The way we see it practiced in the field is new, but this idea of research is not new. Parapsychology and psychical researchers have been doing this for well over 100 years.
And yes. I think it's kind of where media hurt us. Like, before the TV shows and even some of the paranormal radio came out, it was just the best, the people that really cared and were really interested in it. And whether or not society accepted them, they continued to do it, the research, and work hard at it. And just having the best, and yes, I have air quotes there, but just having the best in the field makes a huge difference compared to today, where you have 20 groups and a 20-mile radius in any given city or town.
Go ahead.
I think even to society, that's kind of like, to the people that are calling us for help, having so many groups right there is almost overwhelming to them, and they don't know exactly who to turn to.
That's a very good point. And so many groups are posers, in a sense, that they look good on their website, or sometimes they don't even look good on the website, but people will gravitate towards a group that they see themselves in. So, you know, if you're kind of one particular personality, you're going to search around till you see a website that makes you feel comfortable, so you can basically hear what you want to hear. You brought up a good point about the media, and one thing I've realized in the research of my book, that the media and paranormal go hand in hand, and historically they've always been bedfellows. I'm going to date sort of the modern paranormal scene from 1848, when the Fox sisters first heard their rappings in their home in upstate New York, which pretty much made the spiritualist movement popular in America. One reason the spiritualist movement became so popular in the U.S. is because it coincided with a boom in print media in the newspaper industry. This is really in America. This is when the newspaper industry took off. Immigration was at its highest it had ever been since America became a country. People were becoming more literate. There was a public education system in place, at least in New England. So the newspaper industry was booming, and this really propelled public interest in spiritualism. So the paranormal and media interests basically are like two married people in a dysfunctional relationship, and they may whore around on each other, but they're, you know, they're committed for the long term. This is just the way it is. So as people in the field now, we have to figure out a way to either work around the media or to use it to our advantage. And that's really problematic. It's very problematic. And I think we see that with people who do have shows who are around several years before the show started, who really put in their dues. I think all of us know that probably some compromises have been made. So we have to figure out how to balance this between the media and paranormal interest, because the two are not going to separate. You know, they're not going to get divorced. I guess they're Catholics or something. They're in it for life.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think that the media has, where was I? The TV show, I just went right out of my head. Did you have a question? So I can recap.
Wow, that's just a way to put me right on the spot. Hey, cover for me. Anyway, but why do you think that so many people, you know, kind of fell in love with the spiritual movement at that moment, at that time, instead of just, I guess you could say, staying the course of traditional religions?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. As I said, immigration was at its highest. You know, America had only been a country less than 100 years, around 1848, and there was a huge wave of immigration around that time. One big issue, which a lot of people don't discuss, is Calvinism was the predominant Protestant experience. Calvinism basically perpetrating predestination. So people, when mediums and seances became in vogue, it gave people an opportunity to communicate with the beyond, and it counteracted the influence of Calvinism, because all of a sudden death wasn't this predetermined scary thing. You found it could be quite nice, and you could still communicate with loved ones after they die. But also, this idea of mesmerism was very popular, and mesmerism was a philosophical movement that came from Europe. And the main tenet was that we all have ethers or energies that you could somehow measure or manipulate to improve your health through the use of magnets, because the idea was magnets could somehow manipulate these energies. But spiritual beings also have these ethers or these energies. And that was incredibly influential. And there was an animal magnetism or mesmerism movement in Europe that migrated over to America, and that was extremely popular, and that planted the seeds for spiritualism. So from that time, there was this concept that there were certain energies, certain supernatural energies that could be tapped for spirit communication.
Wow. Thank you. That was great.
And by the way, you know, the church, the Christian, both Protestantism and the church had a big problem with the spiritualist movement, particularly in the South. The New England people were a little bit more open to it, but the South had a hard time with it. A lot of churches, Alabama actually made it illegal to be a spiritualist at the time. And interestingly, many African Americans also gravitated toward the spiritualist movement because it reflected their own animist slave traditions.
Yes. And it was, I can understand the South having a problem with it. I mean, pretty much the South is known as the Bible Belt. And, you know, per capita, I mean, I can't remember the name of the town in Texas, but it's like there's one, and I think in Texas, that has like the most churches ever in one little area.
Well, Texas is big, you know, in general, it's big on everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly churches.
And, I mean, in that area, if you dare to be different, and literally dare, it was a big deal. I mean, you were supposed to be Roman Catholic or some sort of Protestant religion. not a spiritualist or anything else, because that's not right down there in their minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, a lot of people say, well, the spiritualist movement started with the Fox Girls, and they heard these rappings in their home, these direct response rappings, and that's not exactly true. In fact, ghost hunting, a lot of people say Harry Price, for example, British psychical researcher Harry Price was the first ghost hunter because he wrote the first manual called Confessions of a Ghost Hunter, I think in 1936 or 1938. But there were people doing this kind of stuff, particularly in the UK prior to that. In fact, there is an account that there was a woman actually doing early paranormal research, early ghost research. In the UK. So the history of the field is so diverse, and many of us don't know it. I certainly didn't know a lot of this until I started doing research on the book. Jason and Gran are not the first pair of celebrities. The first pair of celebrities were probably the Fox sisters.
Mm-hmm. And I have heard of them. And I have a question for you. Why was it that New England was open to the spiritualism, but yet they're the ones that had the problem with burning witches at the stake, so to speak?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I just want to point out that Jason Hawes is also from upstate New York, so I think there's just something in the water. I don't know. I'm kidding.
I've lived in the South and I've lived in the North, and I could tell you the water is different depending on where you live.
Well, I'm being a bit silly. I think it's because that New England in general was really a hub for immigration. So you had so many different type of people, so many different religious traditions and cultural traditions mixing. New England was also the first area in the U.S. to have public education, and that probably goes a long way because that increased literacy rates. And there was a strong Quaker influence as well in that area. And Quakers and Shakers and these sort of sects, I don't want to call them sects because there's great Quaker people still today, but they were more open to ideas of mesmerism and metaphysical experiences in religion as opposed to the very conservative South. And there are probably class and cultural and gender issues as well.
So you had said that Taps isn't the first paranormal celebrity, and that makes perfect sense. And I was always under the assumption because of Taps, now society outside of paranormal field, our clients, so to speak, are more willing to come out, say they have a ghost in their house or they have a haunted house, and it's not looked down on or made fun of by the rest of the world.
Or at least not to their face.
Right.
No, are you kidding? It is so cool to have a ghost now. It's like the hip thing.
Do you think back in the day when the Fox sisters were around that it was starting way back then to become a little more, I guess, kosher? Or was it not until Jane Grant started that people were actually comfortable with it?
Well, the spiritualist movement made it kosher to go see a medium and to try to communicate with the dead, although there was a lot of criticism, a lot of public criticism, but it made it okay to seek out, to a degree, it made it okay to seek out that experience, and very quickly it merged into an entertainment aspect. There was a lot of fakery and charlatans and exploitation. So, it definitely made it possible. But what Jason and Grant did, what Taps did with the show, is it showed normal, everyday people, just like you and I, openly saying they are having strange things happening in their homes, and it showed normal everyday people, two plumbers, trying to find explanations for it. That average Joe everyday quality we had never seen before, and that's what made the show, particularly the first two seasons, that's what made the show absolutely phenomenal to the American public in my mind.
Right. I think that made a huge difference, the fact that they weren't, you know, scientists in the term of, you know, white lab coats and doctorates upon doctorates and things like that. They were just normal people.
They made Roto-Rooter a lot of money.
Yeah. they sure did. And they were normal people doing it in a very intelligent way. They weren't going in like, oh man, there's a ghost in the corner, let's get a picture of that orb. You know, they were the anti-orb group. They were providing a refreshing, almost intellectual approach to it. That was something you and I could do. And
So Iris had a good question in the chat room. She said that earlier you had mentioned that the ghost investigations and real, I think it was a lot of spiritualism and all that started in the 1800s. Before that, did people not care about the ghost? Did they just take any entity for face value? Did they not think twice when they saw something, or how approached it then?
No, actually, it's the whole idea of ghosts in Western society is very complicated and long and involves the church. There were seances, accounts of seances from the 1700s from Europe, from particularly Germany and France. People were attempting spirit communication from that time. It was just sort of isolated events. But the idea of ghosts, particularly apparitions, has been around forever, I mean, in every culture. But it's interesting that St. Augustine, an early Christian thinker, was concerned enough about it to make a comment. And his thought was that, you know, when we do see apparitions, it's not really the person. It is the image of a person placed in our realm by good or bad spirits. Now, that seems a bit unsophisticated to those of us who are in the field. But what I find very interesting is this is by 300, 400 A.D. that a major Christian thinker thought it was important enough to make an official comment on. So, anyway, I think we're coming up to a break. Is that correct?
Yes, we are going to take a quick break here.
She took our jobs.
Sorry.
So, we're going to take a quick break, and we will...
No, make her wait a little bit longer. And then that way we'll say it'll be our idea, and
okay.
We'll take a break.
All right, there have been ghostly reports of apparitions from, you know, from forever, and... When we come back after the break, I will go into more detail. Oh, sorry, I took it away from you again.
Dang it. We'll never win, Mike. Okay. Sorry.
Leave it to the Muslim to ruin your queue, right?
That's fine. We're all good people here.
Oh, Dawn Shai is listening, but she cannot get into the chat. Can somebody...
Huh. Chris, you there?
Yes, I have to unmute my microphone. You bring me in too quickly. Yes, I can get a hold of Dawn Shai and get her into the chat room.
That would be nice of you.
Yes, that would be lovely. But anyway, we're going to take our break. Fifth Chris here, paying attention. So everybody out there, thank you for listening. We'll be back shortly. And you've been listening to Para Trinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Now I...
From Residual Hauntings Live. As some of you may know, I have run a paranormal group and website for several years. After walking through unwelcoming buildings and ominous cemeteries at night, the biggest challenge I've faced has been finding quality website hosting on a very tight budget. HostYourGhost.com is a high-quality hosting company specifically serving the paranormal community. All HostYourGhost plans include ad-free hosting, email accounts, and an easy-to-use control panel. With packages starting at just $4.99 a month, we scare away the competition. So stop watching your money vaporize and let us host your ghost at HostYourGhost.com.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks, host of that bewitching show, Stirring the Cauldron. And you're stirring it up right now with Michael and Ellie on Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred.
Views and opinions expressed by Paratrinity Radio and their guests are solely theirs and do not represent the views and opinions of ASPRN or its affiliates.
All right, everybody, and we're back. If there is anyone out there listening that cannot... get into the chat room because of the recent changes on the website, go to www.asprn.com/studio.html It is no longer Studio A or Studio B. It's just studio.html. If you go to ASPRN.com on the homepage, there's also a giant thing that says Listen Live, and you can click that and get into the chat room as well. So tonight we are talking to Diona Saeed, and
Boo.
I know we were on a roll before we left for break there. Did you want to go ahead and continue with the history?
Yes, because the history is very fascinating. I would like to know more about, you know, how we got to the point that we're at now.
Well, that would take, like, several shows, so I will try. I will try to summarize. As I said, St. Augustine mentioned apparitions in the early Christian writings. Now, you know, a lot of us assume that, you know, if an intelligent entity is around, many of us assume it has unfinished business or something, you know, like that. You know, there's a reason keeping it here. I found that this idea has existed since medieval times. It has existed since the 1200s, at least. Now, I did not know that. So there's two ways to look at it. We can either say, well, wow, there must be something inherently human in this assumption. Or the other way of looking at it is, my God, we really haven't come very far, have we?
Yeah.
Right.
I would think it's kind of a bit of both.
Could be.
I mean, there are some aspects that it's just like, look at how far we have come and look at how amazing it is and how we're getting it out to, you know, everybody. And then there are other moments where, yeah, you really just kind of sit back and say, wow, we haven't moved an inch.
In a lot of ways, we haven't. You know, from the very beginning, religious experiences, there's always been people who claim to communicate with the dead, the shamans, the pagans, and then the church, you know, came up and suddenly could communicate with God. I mean, they sort of provided the umbrella. But people started to record actual paranormal events, although we can't take everything at face value. What I find interesting is ghost armies started to be seen in the Greek and Roman times all the way up through the Middle Ages. And what I wonder as an investigator is, were they experiencing a residual haunting? Because we have similar accounts around areas of large battlefields. The idea of hearing or seeing major battles. So this, you know, the ghost armies were being reported by the Greeks, the Romans, through the Middle Ages. The Lady in White emerged around the 1300s, the first apparitions of Lady in White, as well as the Ghost in Chains.
Do you know where the Lady in White came from? Like,
I think it was in Germany. I believe it was first recorded in Germany. You know, the Germans are always quite efficient, so.
Right.
So do you think?
So like, did she come over on a boat to come? You know, she was, and then
no,
decided
no,
to populate every state.
She was a ghostly fashion designer, and she designed spiritual attire.
Why is there a lady in white in every state? Is it just that seems to be the popular claim, just because it fits and sounds spooky, or do you think that maybe because ghosts are people that have passed away, that was the way they dressed back in the 1800s and earlier, or whatever? So that's what we're seeing is the way they dressed when they were alive.
I don't know. There might be a scientific reason for that, actually, but I, God knows, I don't know what it is. But it's interesting, you know, that in the Victorian times, people started to see more shadow apparitions, and although reports of apparitions actually decreased, what did increase were apparitions of the living, crisis apparitions. 100 years ago, there were actually more reports of crisis apparitions than there were of ghostly apparitions, and that seems to have shifted now. What people need to understand is that how people describe and interpret paranormal activity has greatly shifted throughout history. And now I'm sorry?
What do you mean by a crisis apparition?
Seeing apparitions of the living and then later realizing that they just died or that they were experiencing some sort of traumatic event.
Oh.
So it's the apparition of someone that is alive at the time that they see them, and then they die shortly thereafter?
Or they have just died. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's almost like the doppelganger. There were more reports of doppelgangers 100 years ago than ghostly apparitions. And it was also during the Victorian era that people started to report more objects being moved and more poltergeist activity.
Would that maybe be why people say that there's, you know, a twin? Everybody has a twin, basically, somewhere in the world. It's because of those doppelgangers.
It could be. I mean, some quantums suggest there are also parallel universes. So, that idea was not at all there in the 1800s. So, yeah, I think a lot of the way we discuss doppelgangers came from the Victorian era. What's very interesting is in the Middle Ages, prior to the Enlightenment, the Catholic Church badly needed people to see apparitions because it gave them proof of purgatory, and they desperately needed this during the Reformation when Protestantism became a major challenge to the Church. The Catholic Church wanted people to be haunted because they needed proof of purgatory. Protestants did not. And this is very interesting. We're going to get into the field of demonology now. There had always been this idea in Europe that apparitions may be demons, but that wasn't popular among the public. But King James, you know, the guy who basically compiled the Bible,
mm-hmm.
he also wrote a book on demonology and witchcraft. And he popularized the idea, as, you know, the king and all, the big Protestant king, he popularized the idea that all apparitions were demonic.
Ooh.
This is who we have to thank for this idea today when we go into a client's home that they're experiencing demonic activity. It's that dude called King James.
Why would he go there? I mean, I mean, what made him think to say that all these ghosts must be demons?
Because it was a political response to the Catholic Church's influence on purgatory. The Protestants were trying to offset the influence of the Catholic Church. Purgatory was a major theological difference. It was purely political on King James' part because he didn't want people believing in purgatory. He wanted people to be Protestants, not Catholics. If apparitions were evidence of purgatory, then he had to turn it into something evil.
Wow. Never knew that. That's interesting.
That is very interesting.
I did not know that.
See, that's what I am, is that, I'm Episcopalian, but his grandfather created because he wanted to have a divorce from his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting. Isn't that wonderful? I follow a religion that says, yay for divorce. But it's just fascinating that he would go that route. I mean, there was no other way he could have thought to go instead of making it evil?
I don't know, maybe. There was increased interest in witchcraft and the occult at this time as well. So it was where society was going, and this was it. This was a way for him to respond and, you know, gain control. It's funny that paranormal activity, particularly apparitional sightings, have always been involved in politics between the church and society up until very recently, probably up until the Enlightenment, when science and the idea of scientism and rationalism became more important to people than the church. So people don't understand that there is a political history to paranormal activity, and I guess in some ways there still is. I mean, there's still a lot of politics. Yeah.
There's politics in everything.
Yes, of course, and God knows there's politics in the field, but that's another show, another time.
Yes. I think the only place where there is no politics is when you have to go to the bathroom.
No, there's politics in there, too, particularly if you're married and you're sharing one bathroom.
Yes, yeah. You weren't supposed to agree to that, Mike. Only I.
So at what point did the Catholic Church start to kind of hide their paranormal? Like, to me, the Catholic and Christian Church doesn't seem to be real fond of paranormal activity. They don't talk about it. You never hear about things that they do, like, say, exorcisms or anything like that. You never hear much from them. And I even hear of churches not liking any mention of paranormal activity, psychics or mediums, people like that.
You know, I can't say for sure, but I think it was probably during the Enlightenment when the idea of science and rationalism came up, and the church realized, hey, you know, these ideas are gaining resonance in society. We need to stop being so dang woo-woo and get on board here. I think that's really when the split occurred. And also, you know, intellectuals 100 years ago were far more willing to research the paranormal than they are now. So the paranormal has become very popular only very recently in our culture, but it was kind of stigmatized before.
So, kind of like how for the longest time, only those that were studying to become priests or, you know, pastors, whatever, could read the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And us commoners couldn't, you know, read it, and we just had to take what our fathers said at face value and just believe them. And when people started reading, that was a huge shift.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that changed everything. That even changed, that helped the idea of nationalism emerge. And paranormal activity also shifted at that time, too, or the way people interpreted and understood it. I'll just say one more thing about sort of the history of ghosts, and then we can move on to Islam, that one great example of how ghosts have sort of changed in the way they behave or the way we understand them is the idea of the phantom hitchhiker is a 20th century addition to ghostly behavior.
It's not.
What?
Are you? Did I miss? I might have missed something. Are you saying it's not?
No, it is. It is. That's, you know, one contribution we've given to
that
ghostly
at all.
Yeah. And faces and orbs. That's another thing.
Nah, there's no faces and orbs. I mean, if you ask some people, orbs are what you see when you go to a strip joint. But
oh my God, they're dust farts, by the way.
So you keep, before we move on to the kind of the Islamic and Muslim part, you keep mentioning it's scientific, and I've heard several people, and I kind of agree. When we do our investigations the way that they're done, and when we talk about it with people here, nothing we really say or do really seems very truly scientific to me. It's technical, it's theological, but like when I think scientific, I think there's a control, something that's proven, something stable, something that's always the same. And I think working in labs and working around the clock nonstop, not 5 hours once a week at an investigation sort of thing. Do you think that it is more scientific than I'm giving it credit for?
No. I mean, let's be realistic. Even the best teams are really not doing real scientific work. It doesn't mean that we're wasting our time. I mean, we are collecting data, and those of us who are meticulous about it are probably collecting better data than others, and probably less data because we're willing to throw things out if there's any question about it. But there are a few groups doing very controlled investigations, very, very few. One group in particular, or one person in particular, is Mark Bacuzzi from the Winbridge Institute, University of Arizona. He's doing very interesting EVP sessions. There's normally three or four people on an EVP session. Cameras cover the entire room. One person, their only job is to write down every sound that is heard. Another person is monitoring video the whole time. Only one person is asking EVP questions. And they normally ask the question three times in a row with a minute in between. Now, that is very rigid, very controlled, but it's probably more scientific than what you and I are doing. And it's a lot more boring. We already know that real investigations are so boring, but if you want to do real science, it's extraordinarily mundane, and honestly, most people don't have the patience for it.
But I think that's what we need to really prove it and to really get it accepted as something a lot more scientific and stable. I mean, I think if there was one group that went into a major haunted location, say, I don't know, Waverly Hills Sanatorium, mm-hmm. and they stayed there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 years, always working around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
I think having that sort of evidence and or not evidence, but that sort of data being collected there and that sort of experience there would really kind of give a lot more credit to what's brought out of it. Because in 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, it's not enough time to really get anything. But when you're there for years or months, mm-hmm. you've got time to really set a strong baseline of what's normal and what's abnormal.
That's true. I mean, that's the ideal situation. But, you know, honestly, to do something like that, you'd basically need funding from a major source, and that's probably not likely to happen anytime soon. But what we can do is just to be very meticulous about the data we are collecting and try to set up as many controls as possible. I'm a firm believer in using video not necessarily to catch evidence, but to document what your team is doing. So when you catch an EVP, you know, hopefully, ideally, you can confirm that nobody else was talking at the time.
Right. It's a big thing that we use.
But I have my question on that before we move on is just, you know, people see psychology as similar. You know, there is no irrefutable proof on certain aspects. It's, you know, a lot of times opinions of the person studying all the literature and the ASM books.
Mm-hmm.
The billions that are out there, and yet they don't know for a definitive fact that that person is truly schizophrenic. They don't know for a definitive fact that they may have a dissociative identity disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what they're, you know, assuming, and we've heard of times when they've misdiagnosed people. So why is it that, and you know, I'm not bashing on psychology because I love psychology, but why is it that can perpetuate, and yet colleges and universities got rid of the parapsychology department?
I think it comes down to metaphysics. People, it really is about metaphysics. Even though there may ultimately be scientific explanations for anomalous events, it comes down to people's belief systems, and people just aren't willing to let go of what their belief systems are. And that's really the last frontier, is getting people to open themselves up metaphysically, and that's extremely difficult to do.
That is true. I guess we would have to just club everybody in the head and say, look, this is how it is. But
just
I guess that would be illegal.
Yeah, or slip everybody some acid and hope they have some sort of metaphysical experience when they trip. And
just don't trip over that metaphorical stick and fall off the building, but...
You know, get them to open their minds, even if we have to feed them drugs. I don't know.
Or we could always just unscrew their heads. Really?
Yeah,
open,
yeah.
Literally.
I want to answer Andrew's question. Say, Deanna, do you think some investigators pull in more EVP than others, and why? Yes, it seems that they do. There is an idea out there called the experimenter effect, that some EVP, not all, but some EVP may actually be psychic projections of our own psi into the environment. I do believe that is firmly possible, actually. I don't think that explains all EVP, but we have noticed some investigators tend to get more legitimate EVP than others, and it's normally tends to be investigators who have some ability, some psychic ability.
That is something I've been curious about, whether or not psychics and mediums can get better evidence because they have that connection.
They're also more open.
Yes.
Because they may be adults, but they don't assume, you know, well, this is the path and anything off this path is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They see it as, you know, everything could possibly be right.
Yeah, they're more, as Don and as you've said, they are more open, and some people who have psychic ability may be subconsciously projecting these things as well. It could be thought form. You know, you have a whole bunch of investigators going in knowing claims of activity, and that may actually create claims of actual activity as well.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and start into the more of the ethnic culture and talking about that. And you had mentioned Jin earlier.
Yes.
From my understanding, the djinn is basically what they would call what we call a ghost. Do they use the word ghost for any sort of entity, or is it spirits and gin?
It's just gin, and let me point out that gin is spelled normally D-G-I-N-N or D-J-I-N-N or J-I-N-N, and it's not the spirit that you drink.
Right.
Or we'd have a lot more people talking about gin.
Exactly. Now, gin are considered inhumans who have free will. They can be good or bad. They are never spoken of as ghosts, although they are blamed for all sorts of paranormal activity in the Muslim world. They are considered to be beings created prior to humanity, prior to humankind. They exist in a different realm. And I'm reading the chat room. I don't need to be distracted by the chat room right now. They exist in a different realm. And as I said earlier, many Muslim scholars believe only the naughty jinn will interfere with our domain. There's a lot of folklore in the Muslim world about jinn, but Islamically, they actually have a position in Islamic law. There, you know, very few Muslims would say the jinn do not exist, but the nature of the jinn is disputed because they are something that is created, it has free will, and it is unseen. A lot of Muslims will say, well, you know what, viruses and bacteria are, you know, they're something in the created world, they have intelligence, and they are also unseen. So, you know, you have a couple of different ways of looking at it.
So yeah, but you can put certain viruses and diseases and bacteria under a microscope and actually see it.
You can't.
You can't really grab a jinn or a ghost and stick it under a microscope and, oh, there it is.
Well, there's a few people who claim you can, but, you know, we're not going to talk about them tonight. But
inhuman spirit, what would a human spirit be? Or do they not believe that there is a such thing?
Islamically, officially, there's not a such thing. Although, in different parts of the Muslim world, people do believe in ghosts, particularly in Egypt. People do believe in the idea of ghosts. Now, what happens when one dies in Christianity? You know, people either go to purgatory, to heaven, or to hell, or whatever. Islam actually has a very interesting way of looking at it, which to me lends itself to the idea of intelligent haunts. When someone dies, our soul continues on a journey, and it goes to something called barzakh, which is time in the grave. No one is allotted to heaven or hell until judgment day. So the time in the grave isn't necessarily purgatory. It's just time in the grave. It's just like a holding pen or a different dimension, which if you've been a decent person, your time will be quite pleasant and quick. If you haven't, you'll be tormented. To me, if no soul has been assigned to heaven or hell yet, and it's just merely a different dimension, then doesn't that logically lend itself to the concept of intelligent hauntings?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Completely. Us, it's like an atheist would think, where the time in the grave is literally that you're just buried and
you
left
rot.
To rot, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I completely agree. It sounds like that would lead to hauntings and intelligent hauntings.
Yes, but an atheist has never been able to explain that we have heard yet what intelligent hauntings are.
Well, I have no idea how an atheist would, you know, how they would talk about this. I'm clueless. Sorry. But
No. It's all right. I'm clueless to it, too. But, so, I know that Catholics believe in the purgatory. So, in that sense, since they believe in purgatory, is that we're... You think that a lot of Catholic people get their idea of ghosts is that these are just people kind of sitting around in the green room waiting to be called up?
I don't know what Catholics think. I think a lot of Catholics think it's demons. I don't know. I mean, talk to Catholics.
Myself, I maybe am an ignorant Catholic. I don't know. But I was always under the impression there's a difference between being in purgatory and being a spirit walking the earth. It's kind of like, I don't know if it's four different levels. There's being a spirit on the earth, a spirit in purgatory, or in heaven, or in hell. But I was always under the impression purgatory was separate, and you were there, not here.
Yeah, that was my impression, too. I mean, one thing, I just want to make a point out that I find very interesting is that one of the most repeated verses in the Quran is God of the Lord of the universes. There's a plural, universes. And it's mentioned in the Quran that there are multiple dimensions and multiple worlds. And to me, from a quantum physics point of view, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And Barzakh or purgatory or whatever, if there are multiple realms and the soul continues on a journey, then it's completely logical that when the veil between these realms thin, that there might be something occurring which we interpret as paranormal activity.
All right.
I mean, it could just be that, you know, people are walking along on, you know, their journey. But I have a question.
Take a break for
yeah. I wasn't going to say it. I was going to let you guys say it this time.
See, we're never going to have to do it. So hold back. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back. You've been listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Unexplained Paranormal Magazine. A publication dedicated to the paranormal and the unexplained. The magazine features articles covering everything from ghosts and hauntings to UFOs and ancient mysteries. You can also expect contributions from experts in the paranormal field, as well as investigations, pictures, feature articles, book reviews, movie reviews, and much, much more. Join us as we explore the unknown. Unexplained Paranormal Magazine. For more information, please visit our website at unexplainedmag.com. That's unexplainedmag.com.
Hi, this is Chris from Tri-State Paranormal, Northern Kentucky. And you're listening to Paratrinity Radio.
Views and opinions expressed by Paratrinity Radio and their guests are solely theirs and do not represent the views and opinions of ASPRN or its affiliates.
And we're back. And before we even start, I'd like to say Happy Easter to everybody. As we just passed the midnight, everyone who celebrates Easter. But I would like to say Happy Easter.
Yes, Happy Easter, everybody who celebrates Easter. If you don't celebrate Easter, happy egg hunting. Because somebody, I'm sure, has put an egg in your lawn. But to go find.
And if you are listening to us and you're not...
Just ignore me, but that's okay. Fine.
I have no remark.
Just go on.
To have... chat in front of you and come up with /studio.html. Join us in the chat room and talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. And we are talking to Deonna Kelly Said. And I wanted to touch on how the Muslims feel about talking to the jinn. And you said that they're inhuman and it's
it's considered a very, very naughty, naughty thing to do to try to talk to jinn. Because jinn, talking to jinn is also related to black magic. And black magic, by the way, in some parts of the Muslim world is actually officially against the law.
Okay.
Wow. So in like Christian religion, talking to the dead is considered necromancy, which is... sin, is that basically the same thing that they see there? The same way they see it there?
Yeah. It would be considered you're involving yourself in black magic, and that is punishable by law in certain countries.
What do you consider black magic? Like, other than talking to jinn?
I don't know what people consider black magic. I think there are different cultural interpretations, but it's basically, manipulating, you know what? It's like psychic attacks. Does mm-hmm. everyone know what psychic attacks is?
Let's assume that they don't.
Okay. Well, I don't know exactly how to say it.
Because I don't.
It's projecting ill will towards an individual or their family, and actually seeing it materialize. In the Muslim world, there's something called the evil eye.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people won't even bring their babies out in public for the first 40 days because they're afraid of the evil eye. It's basically people's energies. What, you know, when they look at you, they're projecting an energy to you. And many times if they're envious of you or jealous, it is assumed that, after, you know, once they see you and they meet with you and then something bad happens, it's because of that. It was the evil eye. Black magic is an extension of that where you're taking energy and just sort of projecting ill will towards someone. And in many cases, it sometimes happens. I don't know why. Parapsychologists would say this is a projection of psi or psychokinesis. But to do that is considered, you know, forbidden in the religion and against the law. A lot of people will go to practitioners to, you know, to make someone fall in love with them in the Muslim world, or to, you know, have a child, become fertile. Sex and babies seems to be a motivation for a lot of people to go to some of these practitioners, men who may be impotent. Now, it's not widely practiced, but it is definitely a subculture throughout the Muslim world.
So when I think black magic, I don't know if this is right, but I automatically think witchcraft.
To a degree, but it's not considered as occultish in the Muslim world as it is here, because a lot of practitioners will actually use religious text to sort of cast spells or whatever, and it's always assumed they're doing it with the help of the jinn. For example, in Afghanistan, my husband is from Afghanistan, in Afghan culture, you can go to one of these practitioners and get something called tawis, which is Quranic verses written on very tiny pieces of paper, and a lot of newly wedded women will go and get tawis done, and they'll hide this in the home as in efforts to sort of have some sort of power over their husbands. And it should work until their husbands find it. That's just one example. And this is, a lot of this is folklore, of course, but it resonates quite strongly in some sectors of society.
I'll have to try that.
Sorry. I'll send you some verses and you can, you know, roll
Please.
It up real tight.
So, you know, the Quran versus the Bible, does your culture, your religion, take the Quran like word for word and really follow it strictly, or is it kind of like the Bible is very, depends on the person and how they interpret it? Is it very up for interpretation like Christian religions have?
It is. Actually, unlike Christianity, Islam, as well as Judaism, has a law, you know, a body of law. And within Islam, there's different schools of thought, which are all considered to be valid. Culturally, I am very much an American. In fact, I'm transcultured. I consider myself a global citizen. So culture and religion are a bit different in a sense. There are definitely slightly different, but yet accepted interpretations of the Quran. Probably the dominant way non-Muslims see the Quran is the way the Saudis interpret it, which is actually the most literal and the most conservative interpretation out there. For example, if you read in the Quran that God sits on a throne, in this particular interpretation, God will literally sit on a throne. A great example of this is the concept of when a Muslim man dies, he has a bunch of virgins waiting for him in heaven.
Yes.
People take that literally. You know, it is a complete metaphor. It's just to demonstrate how pleasurable heaven will be. And it better be a metaphor, because you know what? Men should not get all the goodies in heaven, because when I die, if I go to a Muslim heaven, then I want to be compensated. I want men with, you know, patience and other endowments.
Right. Sorry. Ellie's having headphone issues, so I have to stay there for a moment. Yes, I...
So it's, you know, there's multiple ways to interpret the Quran, but it's the Quran itself has not been changed since the very beginning, and there's an emphasis on memorizing the Quran, so there's always a verbal record should there ever not be a written record. So the Quran is the same from the time it was compiled. There's no King James in Islam, put it that way.
Right. I think that's, I guess, a great idea, so to speak, to do that. I mean, the Bible's been redone so many different times, like you said, King James Version, and there's all sorts of new versions and new editions. And you look up what one verse is, and you can find 10 different translations of that same sentence.
That's why the Quran is in Arabic. It was revealed in Arabic, and you do certainly get translations. There are people who make comments. There are accepted commentary on the Quran, but there's no big issue. You don't have 5,000 different versions. It's just one version.
And that seems much more logical. So as a paranormal investigator in America and being Muslim, do you find that that society treats you any differently? Do they accept you? Do people have any problems with you doing investigations? Do you find more people that are Muslim call you for help? How is that?
Not yet. I don't think Muslims know what I do. I don't know if I want them to know what I do. I mean, you know, I was raised in the rural South. I was raised as a Southern Baptist. I accepted Islam many years before I married. I didn't marry into the religion. I was already a Muslim. So I think, I'm an American. I mean, I understand America and behave as an American, even though my head is covered. I don't know exactly what Muslims would say when they find out I'm actually going out and sitting in the dark with a bunch of strange people, a lot of strange men, trying to get unseen things to talk to me. That's probably not going to go over very well once more people find out about it. But, you know, I'm trying to find a way to talk about it with Muslims to demonstrate that this is – when I experience something really cool in an investigation – it makes me say, you know what? The world that God has created is absolutely awesome. It affirms my faith in a higher power.
Right. I can definitely see that, how it confirms your faith.
And it's not necessarily that I'm trying to find proof of afterlife. I'm just like, God has created this awesome world, and it's ours to discover. And that's in Islam, you know God by inquiry, by intellectual inquiry, and that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. So when you go out and do the investigations, do you stick with the beliefs you have as a Muslim and kind of steer away from some of the things that we do?
I go out and investigate probably the same way you do. I just, keep in mind that there might be alternative ways to investigate or to interpret the activity. For me, I do believe there might be something called jinn. I don't know if they're all mean or good or whatever, but I also believe that, there's something else occurring too. Whether it's souls that are just sort of floating around or are people's leftover residual consciousness that's left here after they die? I don't know, but to me there is an explanation for it, and it will probably come from science, and it will reaffirm metaphysics in many ways. That's my hope, at least.
Okay. We're getting pretty close to the end of the show here, about 12 minutes, and I know you had several things you wanted to talk about and to plug, so I think we should go ahead and get to that, make sure you get a chance. First of all, why don't you give a plug out for your group and you personally as an author?
Okay, well, my group is Haunted North Carolina. I just put the website in the chat room. Is on hauntednc.com. Proud Tepps family member. We've been around since 1992. And I have a book, You Had Me at Boo, America's Fascination with the Paranormal, that should be released in 2011. Starting April 30th, 9 p.m. Friday, I'm starting a forum on liveparanormal.com called Paranormal Think Tank. It's an effort to elevate the discussion in the field, let people come on, particularly paracelebrities, and actually talk as investigators, bring interesting people in the field from investigators to remote viewers, and have a real full discussion, hopefully. That will be bi-weekly. And I do have a website that should be up in a few days, DeonnaKellySaied.com. That's DeonnaKellySaied.com. And occasionally I have articles up at GhostVillage.com, which is facilitated by the Jeff Bellinger. So check there occasionally and you might see something from me.
Cool. And you've also had an article published in the Tapps Para magazine, haven't you?
I have, on Islam and the Paranormal. That was February of last year, I believe. Yep, it was February of last year, Islam and the Paranormal.
Have you been published in other magazines, or is that...
Not in the paranormal field. Not paranormal magazines.
Okay. All right. We had a question in the chat room about when you investigate, do you use trigger methods to help kind of bring out activity?
Is somebody calling me on Skype? One of you guys?
That's not me.
I have no idea. I'm trying to find creative ways to do EVP sessions. I'm sort of in an experimental phase. I don't try to go out and deliberately talk to Jin because I'm a little bit scared of what I might encounter. Barry Fitzgerald apparently had an experience with Jin, and he said it burned through all of his equipment. So I'm a little bit reluctant to deliberately go out look for Jin. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, I thought the sound dropped. I think a lot of us, no matter how intelligent or experienced we are, we duplicate what we see on TV when it comes to EVP sessions. So I am deliberately, consciously trying to distance myself from that and find extraordinarily creative ways to conduct investigations. And believe me, it is a challenge. It's really a challenge. Don Shai is right. Gives your best EVPs when you're not trying. That could very well be true.
Yep. You know what? Ellie is having big technical difficulties here. She can't hear anything, and when she does get something, it's coming out of her computer, so then it's coming right through my microphone. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We might go a little bit over, maybe a couple minutes over. But let's take another real quick break, if you can, Chris. I know it's short notice.
Incredibly short notice. I don't have any music ready, but I'm quick on the draw.
Given the commercials are fine, I don't care, but I want to get her back online talking.
Alrighty. Ready for a break whenever you are, Mike.
Okay. I apologize, everybody. I want to get her back on. I want to get going with this. So thanks for sticking around and keep listening. We'll be right back. You've been listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
River City's Paranormal Society. Paranormal investigators that don't suck. Serving the Wisconsin area, RCPS is a member of the TAPS family. Contact us at area code 715-424-3084 or join our paranormal community at rcpswi.com.
All right, and we're back, everybody. If you're listening and you're not in the chat room, come on over to ASPRN.com and click on the Listen Live button. And we're talking to Diona Saeed. And I had kind of a different question for you. Come back.
Okay.
Believe in aliens.
I believe in the possibility of aliens. And one thing the Quran states is that life forms, this is an actual verse, life forms are scattered throughout the heavens, and God has the ability to gather them all at will. So most Muslims certainly accept the possibility of aliens. Until one actually lands in my yard, I'm not going to be too concerned about it. But, I do believe in the possibility.
What about cryptozoology, like Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster? Are there any, do you believe in those, or are you interested in that sort of study at all, and are there any big ones over in the, and where you're from?
Well, I'm from North Florida, so we do have a couple of swamp monsters and weird people with mullet hairdos, but, in the Muslim world, there are some accounts of weird animals, but I'm not that interested in cryptozoology, but from a purely sort of biodiversity point of view, I don't see why there could be some species out there that we haven't yet identified. I don't know if Bigfoot is actually alive, but there definitely could be species out there that we just haven't gotten around to naming.
Those two, crypto and aliens, are two of the things that I find the hardest to believe. I mean, I guess I can believe that there's animals out there that haven't been proven and named as a specific species. That's not that hard to believe. But the way that it's talked about in the paranormal field, that they're paranormal and they're almost like deformed, I guess you could say.
Mythical creatures?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I was accepting it, I think.
Yeah, you know, we as investigators have to admit that a lot of discussions are completely folkloric. It doesn't mean that there's not something behind it that's interesting, but the way people understand and interpret anything that defies the norm is always going to be filtered through culture. And we have to accept that. And Don Shai says, Bigfoot is something that we experience through a rift in time. That could be possible. As quantum physicists and really do more research and understand that there are parallel universes, that is entirely possible.
Right. That was really loud.
Yeah. That was, yeah, that right there, you know, that was a time hiccup.
Yeah, that was Ellie trying to come back into the call. That loud static, I don't know if you heard that or not. Mm-hmm. But it's 12:30 here, so we're at the end of the show here. So I think we're going to wrap it up. I wanted to thank you greatly for coming on. I've learned so much. A lot of this history I never knew, could even find it in research. So what you've said is very, very interesting and just fascinating by me. I'm definitely going to be looking for your book when it comes out.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry I didn't get more into Islam and the paranormal, but yeah, I'm fascinated by my own research as well. So I
apologize for the unexpected difficulties we've had here. So, if you don't mind sticking around for a moment, I'd like to talk to you after the show just for a couple minutes.
Sure, no problem.
All right. So, everybody out there, thank you for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great holiday. Have a happy Easter. And I'm sure Ellie would say have a happy Easter if she could get connected. And next week, we are going to be talking to... Hold on. Getting there. Next week we will be talking to Corvus Nocturnum. He is actually another show host on ASPRN. His show is the first and third Wednesday of every month on Wednesday. And he is a vampire. I believe he's a Satanist as well. So we're going to be talking to him and kind of get some of his views. Looking forward to hearing about that, because it makes vampires look bad, I guess. So I'm curious to see what the reality is. And so until then, thank you, everybody. Enjoy the new ASPRN website, and we will talk to you then. You've been listening to the all of... Well, I screwed that up. Trinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network. Have a good night.
Tune in next Saturday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to Paratrinity Radio with Mike and Ellie. Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred, right here on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.